to Jamie about my own time, but the idea of sexual freedom wasn't one of them. Oh! The relief in his voice was inexpressible, and I bit my lip to keep from laughing. I was sure of it. Only I... that is... He stopped and swallowed. "Bree's a very good girl," I said. I squeezed his arm lightly. "Frank and I may not have got on so well together, but we were both good parents to her, if I do say so." "Aye, I knew you were. I didn't mean to say otherwise." He had the grace to look abashed and tucked the beach picture carefully back into the packet. He put the pictures back into his pocket, patting them to be sure they were safe. He stood looking up at the moon, then his brows drew together in a slight frown. The sea wind lifted strands of his hair, tugging them loose from the ribbon that bound it, and he brushed them back absent-mindedly. Clearly, there was still something on his mind.
"Do you think," he began slowly, not looking at me, "do you think that it was quite wise to come to me now, Claire? Not that I dinna want you," he added hastily, feeling me stiffen beside him.
He caught my hand, preventing my turning away.
"No, I didn't mean that at all. Christ, I do want you."
He drew me closer, pressing my hand in his against his heart.
"I want you so badly that sometimes I think my heart will burst with the joy of having you,"
he added more softly.
"It's only... Brian is alone now. Frank is gone, and you. She has no husband to protect her, no men of her family to see her safely wed. Will she not have need of you a while yet? Should you no have waited a bit, I mean?"
I paused before answering, trying to get my own feelings under control. "I don't know," I said at last. My voice quivered in spite of my struggle to control it.
"Look, things aren't the same then. I know that. You don't!"
I pulled my hand loose and glared at him. "You don't know, Jamie, and there isn't any way for me to tell you because you won't believe me. But Bree's a grown woman. She'll marry when and as she likes, not when someone arranges it for her. She doesn't need to marry, for that matter. She's having a good education. She can earn her own living. Women do that. She won't have to have a man to protect her."
"And if there's no need for a man to protect a woman and care for her, then I think it will be a very poor time."
He glared back at me. I drew a deep breath, trying to be calm.
"I didn't say there's no need for it."
I placed a hand on his shoulder and spoke in a softer tone. "I said she can choose. She needn't take a man out of necessity. She can take one for love." His face began to relax, just slightly.
"You took me from need," he said, "when we wed."
"And I came back for love," I said. "Do you think I needed you any less, only because I could feed myself?" The lines of his face eased, and the shoulder under my hand relaxed a bit as he searched my face.
"No," he said softly, "I dinna think that."
He put his arm around me and drew me close. I put my arms around his waist and held him, feeling the small flat patch of Brianna's pictures in his pocket under my cheek. "I did worry about leaving her," I whispered a little later. "She made me go. We were afraid that if I waited longer, I might not be able to find you. But I did worry."
"I know. I shouldn't have said anything."
He brushed my curls away from his chin, smoothing them down. "I left her a letter," I said.
"It was all I could think to do, knowing I might not see her again."
I pressed my lips tight together and swallowed hard. His fingertips stroked my back very softly.
"Aye, that was good, Sassnach. What did you say to her?"
I laughed a little shakily. Everything I could think of. Motherly advice and wisdom, what I had of it. All the practical things, where the deed to the house and the family papers were, and everything I knew or could think of about how to live. I expect she'll ignore it all and have a wonderful life. But at least she'll know I thought about her. It had taken me nearly a week going through the cupboards and desk drawers of the house in Boston, finding all of the business papers, the bank books and mortgage papers and the family things. There were a good many bits and pieces of Frank's family lying about, huge scrapbooks and dozens of genealogy charts, albums of photographs, cartons of saved letters. My side of the family was a good deal simpler to sum up. I lifted down the box I kept on the shelf of my closet. It was a small box. Uncle Lambert was a saver, as all scholars are, but there had been little to save. The essential documents of a small family, birth certificates, mine and my parents, their marriage lines, the registration for the car that had killed them. What ironic whim had prompted Uncle Lamb to save that? More likely, he had never opened the box, but only kept it in a scholar's blind faith that information must never be destroyed, for who knew what use it might be, and to whom? I had seen its contents before, of course. There had been a period in my teens when I opened it nightly to look at the few photos it contained. I remembered the bone-deep longing for the mother I didn't remember, and the vain effort to imagine her, to bring her back to life from the small dim images in the box. The best of them was a close-up photograph of her, face turned toward the camera, warm eyes and a delicate mouth, smiling under the brim of a felt cloche hat. The photograph had been hand-tinted. The cheeks and lips were an unnatural rose pink, the eyes soft brown. Uncle Lamb said that that was wrong. Her eyes had been gold, he said, like mine. I thought perhaps that time of deep need had passed for Brianna, but wasn't sure. I had had a studio portrait made of myself the week before. I placed it carefully in the box and closed it, and put the box in the centre of my desk where she would find it. Then I sat down to write. "My dear Bree," I wrote, and stopped. I couldn't possibly be contemplating abandoning my child. To see those three black words stark on the page brought the whole mad idea into a cold clarity that struck me to the bone. My hand shook, and the tip of the pen made small wavering circles in the air above the paper. I put it down and clasped my hands between my thighs, eyes closed. "Get a grip on yourself, Beecham," I muttered. "Write the bloody thing and have done. If she doesn't need it, it will do no harm. And if she does, it will be there." I picked up the pen and began again. "I don't know if you will ever read this, but perhaps it's as well to set it down. This is what I know of your grandparents, your real ones, your great-grandparents, and your medical history." I wrote for some time, covering page after page. My mind grew calmer with the effort of recall and the necessity of setting down the information clearly. And then I stopped, thinking. What could I tell her beyond those few bare, bloodless facts? How to impart what sparse wisdom I had gained in 48 years of a fairly eventful life? My mouth twisted wryly in consideration of that. Did any daughter listen? Would I, had my mother been there to tell me? It made no difference, though. I would just have to set it down, to be of use if it could. But what was true, that would last forever, in spite of changing times and ways? What would stand her in good stead? Most of all, how could I tell her just how much I loved her? The enormity of what I was about to do gaped before me, and my fingers clenched tight on the pen. I couldn't think, not and do this. I could only set the pen to the paper and hope. "Baby," I wrote and stopped, then swallowed hard and started again. "You are my baby, and always will be. You won't know what that means until you have a child of your own, but I'll tell you now anyway. You'll always be as much a part of me as when you shared my body and I felt you move inside.
always. I can look at you asleep and think of all the nights I tucked you in, coming in the dark to listen to your breathing, lay my hand on you and feel your chest rise and fall, knowing that no matter what happens, everything is right with the world because you are alive. All the names I've called you through the years, my chick, my pumpkin, precious dove, darling, sweetheart, dinky, smudge. I know why the Jews and Muslims have 900 names for God. One small word is not enough for love. I blinked hard to clear my vision and went on writing fast. I didn't dare take time to choose my words, or I would never write them. I remember everything about you, from the tiny line of golden down that zigged across your forehead when you were hours old, to the bumpy toenail on the big toe you broke last year when you had that fight with Jeremy and kicked the door of his pickup truck. God, it breaks my heart to think it will stop now, that watching you, seeing all the tiny changes, I won't know when you stop biting your nails, if you ever do. Seeing you grow suddenly taller than I, and your face take its shape. I always will remember Bree. I always will. There's probably no one else on earth, Bree, who knows what the back of your ears looked like when you were 3 years old. I used to sit beside you reading One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish, or The Three Billy Goats Gruff, and see those ears turn pink with happiness. Your skin was so clear and fragile, I thought a touch would leave fingerprints on you. You look like Jamie, I told you. You have something from me too, though. Look at the picture of my mother in the box, and the little black and white one of her mother and grandmother. You have that broad, clear brow they have. So do I. I've seen a good many of the Frasers too. I think you'll age well if you take care of your skin. Take care of everything, Bree. Oh, I wish... Well, I have wished I could take care of you and protect you from everything all your life. But I can't, whether I stay or go. Take care of yourself, though, for me. The tears were puckering the paper now. I had to stop to blot them, lest they smear the ink beyond reading. I wiped my face and resumed, slower now. You should know, Bree. I don't regret it. In spite of everything, I don't regret it. You'll know something now of how lonely I was for so long without Jamie. It doesn't matter. If the price of that separation was your life, neither Jamie nor I can regret it. I know he wouldn't mind my speaking for him. Bree, you are my joy. You're perfect and wonderful. And I hear you saying now in that tone of exasperation, but of course you think that. You're my mother. Yes, that's how I know. Bree, you are worth everything and more. I've done a great many things in my life so far. But the most important of them all was to love your father and you. I blew my nose and reached for another fresh sheet of paper. That was the most important thing. I could never say all I felt, but this was the best I could do. What might I add to be of aid in living well, in growing up and growing old? What had I learned that I might pass on to her? Choose a man like your father, I wrote. Either of them. I shook my head over that. Could there be two men more different? But left it, thinking of Roger Wakefield. Once you've chosen a man, don't try to change him, I wrote with more confidence. It can't be done. More important, don't let him try to change you. He can't do it either. But men always try. I bit the end of the pen, tasting the bitter tang of India ink.
And finally, I put down the last and the best advice I knew on growing older. Stand up straight and try not to get fat.
With all my love, always, Mama.
Jamie's shoulders shook as he leaned against the rail, whether with laughter or some other emotion, I couldn't tell. His linen glowed white with moonlight, and his head was dark against the moon. At last he turned and pulled me to him.
"I think she will do very well," he whispered, "for no matter what poor Gowka's fathered her, no lass has ever had a better mother. Kiss me, Sassenach, for believe me, I wouldna change you for the world."
Chapter 43 Phantom Limbs. Fergus, Mr. Willoughby, Jamie, and I had all kept careful watch upon the six Scottish smugglers since our departure from Scotland, but there wasn't the slightest hint of suspicious behaviour from any of them, and after a time I found myself relaxing my wariness around them. Still, I felt some reserve toward most of them, save Innes. I had finally realised why neither Fergus nor Jamie thought him a possible traitor. With but one arm, Innes was the only smuggler who couldn't have strung up the exciseman on the Arbroath Road. Innes was a quiet man. None of the Scots was what one might call garrulous, but even by their high standards of taciturnity, he was reserved. I was therefore not surprised to see him grimacing silently one morning, bent over behind a hatch cover, evidently engaged in some silent internal battle. "Have you a pain, Innes?" I asked, stopping. "Ugh!" he straightened, startled, but then fell back into his half-crouched position, his one arm locked across his belly. "Mm-hmm," he muttered, his thin face flushing at being so discovered. "Come along with me," I said, taking him by the elbow. He looked frantically about for salvation, but I towed him, resisting, but not audibly protesting, back to my cabin, where I forced him to sit upon the table and removed his shirt so that I could examine him. I palpated his lean and hairy abdomen, feeling the firm, smooth mass of the liver on one side and the mildly distended curve of the stomach on the other. The intermittent way in which the pains came on, causing him to writhe like a worm on the hook, then passing off, gave me a good idea that what troubled him was simple flatulence, but best to be thorough. I probed for the gallbladder, just in case, wondering as I did so just what I would do should it prove to be an acute attack of cholecystitis or an inflamed appendix. I could envision the cavity of the belly in my mind as though it lay open, in fact, before me, my fingers translating the soft, lumpy shapes beneath the skin into vision, the intricate folds of the intestines softly shielded by their yellow quilting of fat-padded membrane, the slick, smooth lobes of the liver, deep purple-red, so much darker than the vivid scarlet of the heart's pericardium above. Opening that cavity was a risky thing to do, even equipped with modern anaesthetics and antibiotics. Sooner or later, I knew, I would be faced with the necessity of doing it, but I sincerely hoped it would be later. "Breathe in," I said, hands on his chest, and saw in my mind the pink-flushed, grainy surface of a healthy lung. "Breathe out now," and felt the colour fade to soft blue. No rails, no halting. A nice, clear flow. I reached for one of the thick sheets of vellum paper I used for stethoscopes. "When did you last move your bowels?" I inquired, rolling the paper into a tube. The Scot's thin face turned the colour of fresh liver. Fixed with my gimlet eye, he mumbled something incoherent in which the word "four" was just distinguishable. "4 days?" I said, forestalling his attempts to escape by putting a hand on his chest and pinning him flat to the table. "Hold still. I'll just have a listen here to be sure." The heart sounds were reassuringly normal. I could hear the valves open and close with their soft, meaty clicks, all in the right places. I was quite sure of the diagnosis, had been virtually from the moment I'd looked at him. But by now there was an audience of heads peering curiously round the doorway, Innes's mates watching. For effect, I moved the end of my tubular stethoscope down farther, listening for belly sounds. Just as I thought, the rumble of trapped gas was clearly audible in the upper curve of the large intestine. The lower sigmoid colon was blocked, though. No sound at all down there.
"You have belly gas," I said, "and constipation."
"Aye, I ken that fine," Innes muttered, looking frantically for his shirt.
I put my hand on the garment in question, preventing him from leaving while I catechised him about his diet of late. Not surprisingly, this consisted almost entirely of salt pork and hardtack.
"What about the dried peas and the oatmeal?"
I asked, surprised. Having inquired as to the normal fare aboard ship, I had taken the precaution of stowing, along with my surgeon's cask of lime juice and the collection of medicinal herbs, 300 pounds of dried peas and a similar quantity of oatmeal, intending that this should be used to supplement the seaman's normal diet. Innes remained tongue-tied, but this inquiry unleashed a flood of revelation and grievance from the onlookers in the doorway. Jamie, Fergus, Massali, and I all dined daily with Captain Raines, feasting on Murphy's ambrosia, so I was unaware of the deficiencies of the crew's mess. Evidently the difficulty was Murphy himself, who, while holding the highest culinary standards for the captain's table, considered the crew's dinner to be a chore rather than a challenge. He had mastered the routine of producing the crew's meals quickly and competently, and was highly resistant to any suggestions for an improved menu that might require further time or trouble. He declined absolutely to trouble with such nuisances as soaking peas or boiling oatmeal. Compounding the difficulty was Murphy's ingrained prejudice against oatmeal, a crude Scottish mess that offended his aesthetic sense. I knew what he thought about that, having heard him muttering things about dog's vomit over the trays of breakfast that included the bowls of porridge to which Jamie, Massali and Fergus were addicted.
"Mr. Murphy says as how salt pork and hardtack is good enough for every crew he's had to feed for 30 years. Given figgy dowdy or plum duff for pudding, and beef on Sundays too. Though if that's beef, I'm a Chinaman. And it's good enough for us," Gordon burst in.
Accustomed to polyglot crews of French, Italian, Spanish and Norwegian sailors, Murphy was also accustomed to having his meals accepted and consumed with a voracious indifference that transcended nationalities. The Scots' stubborn insistence on oatmeal roused all his own Irish intransigence, and the matter, at first a small simmering disagreement, was now beginning to rise to the boil.
"We knew as there was meant to be porridge," MacLeod explained, "for Fergus did say so when he asked us to come, but it's been nothing but the meat and biscuits since we left Scotland, which is a wee bit griping to the belly if you're not used to it." "We dinna like to trouble Jamie Royal with such a thing," Rayburn put in. "Geordie's got his girdle, and we've been making our own oat cake over the lamps in the crew quarters, but we've run through what corn we brought in our bags, and Mr. Murphy's got the keys to the pantry store."
He glanced shyly at me under his sandy blonde lashes.
"We dinna like to ask, knowing what he thought of us." "You wouldna ken what's meant by the term spalpeen, would you, Mistress Fraser?"
Macrae asked, raising one bushy brow. While listening to this outpouring of woe, I had been selecting assorted herbs from my box, anise and angelica, two large pinches of horehound, and a few sprigs of peppermint. Tying these into a square of gauze, I closed the box and handed Innes his shirt, into which he burrowed at once in search of refuge. "I'll speak to Mr. Murphy," I promised the Scots. "Meanwhile," I said to Innes, handing him the gauze bundle, "brew you a good pot of tea from that, and drink a cupful at every watch change. If we've had no results by tomorrow, we'll try stronger measures." As if in answer to this, a high squeaking fart emerged from under Innes to an ironic cheer from his colleagues.
"Aye, that's right, Mistress Fraser. Maybe you can scare the shit out of him,"
MacLeod said, a broad grin splitting his face. Innes, scarlet as a ruptured artery, took the bundle, bobbed his head in inarticulate thanks, and fled precipitously, followed in more leisurely fashion by the other smugglers. A rather acrimonious debate with Murphy followed, terminating without bloodshed, but with the compromise that I would be responsible for the preparation of the Scots morning porridge, permitted to do so under provision that I confine myself to a single pot and spoon, did not sing while cooking, and was careful not to make a mess in the precincts of the sacred galley. It was only that night, tossing restlessly in the cramped and chilly confines of my berth, that it occurred to me how odd the morning's incident had been. Were this Lallybroch and the Scots Jamie's tenants, not only would they have had no hesitation in approaching him about the matter, they would have had no need to. He would have known already what was wrong and taken steps to remedy the situation. Accustomed as I had always been to the intimacy and unquestioning loyalty of Jamie's own men, I found this distance troubling. Jamie was not at the captain's table next morning, having gone out in the small boat with two of the sailors to catch whitebait. But I met him on his return at noon, sunburned, cheerful, and covered with scales and fish blood.
"What have you done to Innes Sassenach?" he said, grinning. "He's hiding in the starboard head, and says you told him he mustn't have come out at all until he'd shit."
"I didn't tell him that exactly," I explained. "I just said if he hadn't moved his bowels by tonight, I'd give him an enema of slippery elm." Jamie glanced over his shoulder in the direction of the head.
"Well, I suppose we will hope that Innes's bowels cooperate, or I doubt but he'll spend the rest of the voyage in the head, with a threat like that hanging over him."
"Well, I shouldn't worry. Now that he and the others have their porridge back, their bowels ought to take care of themselves without undue interference from me." Jamie glanced down at me, surprised.
"Got the porridge back? Whatever do you mean, Sassenach?"
I explained the genesis of the oatmeal war and its outcome as he fetched a basin of water to clean his hands. A small frown drew his brows close together as he pushed his sleeves up his arms.
"They ought to have come to me about it," he said.
"I expect they would have, sooner or later," I said. "I only happened to find out by accident when I found Innes grunting behind a hatch cover."
"Mm-hmm."
He set about scouring the bloodstains off his fingers, rubbing the clinging scales free with a small pumice stone. "These men aren't like your tenants at Lallybroch, are they?" I said, voicing the thought I had had.
"No," he said quietly.
He dipped his fingers in the basin, leaving tiny shimmering circles where the fish scales floated.
"I'm no their laird, only the man who pays them."
"They like you, though," I protested. Then, remembering Fergus's story, and amended this rather weakly too, "or at least five of them do." I handed him the towel. He took it with a brief nod and dried his hands. Looking down at the strip of cloth, he shook his head.
"Aye, MacLeod and the rest like me well enough. Or five of them do," he repeated ironically. "And they'll stand by me if it's needful. Five of them. But they dinna ken me much, nor me them, save Innes."
He tossed the dirty water over the side, and tucking the empty basin under his arm, turned to go below, offering me his arm.
"There was more died at Culloden than the Stuart cause, Sassenach," he said. "You'll be coming for your dinner now."
I did not find out why Innes was different until the next week. Perhaps emboldened by the success of the purgative I had given him, Innes came voluntarily to call upon me in my cabin a week later.
"I am wondering, mistress," he said politely, "whether there might be a medicine for something as isna there."
"What?" I must have looked puzzled at this description, for he lifted the empty sleeve of his shirt in illustration.
"My arm," he explained. "It's no there, as you can plainly see. And yet it pains me something terrible sometimes."
He blushed slightly.
I did wonder for some years was I only a bit mad, he confided in lowered tones. But I spoke a bit with Mr. Murphy, and he tells me it's the same with his leg that got lost. And Fergus says he wakes sometimes, feeling his missing hand slide into someone's pocket.
He smiled briefly, teeth a flash under his drooping moustache.
So I thought maybe if it was a common thing to feel a limb that wasn't there, perhaps there was something that might be done about it.
I see.
I rubbed my chin, pondering.
Yes, it is common. It's called a phantom limb when you still have feelings in a part that's been lost.
As for what to do about it?
I frowned, trying to think whether I had ever heard of anything therapeutic for such a situation. To gain time, I asked, how did you happen to lose the arm?
Oh, 'twas the blood poison, he said casually. I tore a small hole in my hand wi' a nail one day and it festered.
I stared at the sleeve, empty from the shoulder.
I suppose it did, I said faintly.
Oh, aye. It was a lucky thing, though. It was that stopped me being transported wi' the rest.
The rest of whom?
He looked at me, surprised.
Why, the other prisoners from Ardsmuir. Did MacDhu no tell you about that? When they stopped the fortress from being a prison, they sent off all of the Scottish prisoners to be indenture men in the colonies. All but MacDhu, for he was a great man, and they didna want him out of their sight. And me, for I'd lost the arm and was no good for hard labour. So MacDhu was taken somewhere else, and I was let go, pardoned and set free. So you see, it was a most fortunate accident, save only for the pain that comes on sometimes at night.
He grimaced and made as though to rub the non-existent arm, stopping and shrugging at me in illustration of the problem.
I see. So you were with Jamie in prison?
I didn't know that. I was turning through the contents of my medicine chest, wondering whether a general pain reliever like willow bark tea or whorehound with fennel would work on a phantom pain.
Oh, aye.
Innes was losing his shyness and beginning to speak more freely. I should have been dead of starvation by now had MacDhu not come to find me when he was released himself.
He went looking for you.
Out of the corner of my eye I spotted a flash of blue and beckoned to Mr. Willoughby, who was passing by.
Aye. When he was released from his parole, he came to inquire to see whether he could trace any of the men who'd been taken to America, to see whether any might have returned.
He shrugged, the missing arm exaggerating the gesture.
But there were none in Scotland, save me.
I see. Mr. Willoughby, have you a notion what might be done about this?
Motioning to the Chinese to come and look, I explained the problem and was pleased to hear that he did indeed have a notion. We stripped Innes of his shirt once again, and I watched, taking careful notes, as Mr. Willoughby pressed hard with his fingers at certain spots on the neck and torso, explaining as best he might what he was doing.
Arm is in the ghost world, he explained. Body not, here in upper world. Arm tries to come back, for it does not like to be away from body. This, anmu, press, press, this stops pain. But also we tell arm not to come back.
How'd you do that?
Innes was becoming interested in the procedure.
Most of the crew wouldn't let Mr. Willoughby touch them, regarding him as heathen, unclean, and a pervert to boot. But Innes had known and worked with the Chinese for the last 2 years.
Mr. Willoughby shook his head, lacking words, and burrowed in my medicine box. He came up with the bottle of dried hot peppers, and shaking out a careful handful, put it into a small dish.
Have fire? He inquired.
I had a flint and steel, and with these he succeeded in kindling a spark to ignite the dried herb. The pungent smell filled the cabin, and we all watched as a small plume of white rose up from the dish and formed a small hovering cloud over the dish.
Send smoke of Fan Zhao messenger to Ghost World. Speak, arm,
Mr. Willoughby explained. Inflating his lungs, and puffing out his cheeks like a blowfish, he blew lustily at the cloud, dispersing it. Then, without pausing, he turned and spat copiously on Innes's stump.
"Why, ye heathen bugger!"
Innes cried, eyes bulging with fury.
"D'ye dare spit on me?"
"Spit on ghost!"
Mr. Willoughby explained, taking three quick steps backward toward the door.
"Ghost afraid spittle. Not come back now, right away."
I laid a restraining hand on Innes's remaining arm. "Does your missing arm hurt now?" I asked. The rage began to fade from his face as he thought about it.
"Well, no,"
he admitted. Then he scowled at Mr. Willoughby.
"But that doesna mean I'll have you spit on me, whatever the fancy takes you, you wee poutworm." "Oh, no,"
Mr. Willoughby said, quite cool.
"I not spit. You spit now. Scare you own ghost."
Innes scratched his head, not sure whether to be angry or amused.
"Well, I will be damned," he said finally.
He shook his head, and picking up his shirt, pulled it on.
"Still," he said, "I think perhaps next time I'll try your tea, Mistress Freezer."
Chapter 44. Forces of Nature.
"I," said Jamie, "I'm a fool."
He spoke broodingly, watching Fergus and Massali, who were absorbed in close conversation by the rail on the opposite side of the ship. "What makes you think so?" I asked, though I had a reasonably good idea. The fact that all four of the married persons aboard were living in unwilling celibacy had given rise to a certain air of suppressed amusement among the members of the crew, whose celibacy was involuntary.
"I have spent 20 years longing to have you in my bed,"
he said, verifying my assumption.
"And within a month of having you back again, I've arranged matters so that I cannae even kiss you without sneaking behind a hatch cover. And even then, half the time I look round to find Fergus looking cross-eyed down his nose at me, the little bastard. And no one to blame for it but my own foolishness. What did I think I was doing?"
he demanded rhetorically, glaring at the pair across the way, who were nuzzling each other with open affection.
"Well, Massali is only 15, I said mildly. "I expect you thought you were being fatherly, or stepfatherly."
"Aye, I did."
He looked down at me with a grudging smile.
"The reward for my tender concern being that I canna even touch my own wife."
"Oh, you can touch me," I said.
I took one of his hands, caressing the palm gently with my thumb. "You just can't engage in acts of unbridled carnality." We had had a few abortive attempts along those lines, all frustrated by either the inopportune arrival of a crew member or the sheer uncongeniality of any nook aboard the Artemis sufficiently secluded as to be private. One late-night foray into the after-hold had ended abruptly when a large rat had leapt from a stack of hides onto Jamie's bare shoulder, sending me into hysterics and depriving Jamie abruptly of any desire to continue what he was doing. He glanced down at our linked hands, where my thumb continued to make secret love to his palm, and narrowed his eyes at me. But let me continue. He closed his fingers gently round my hand, his own thumb feather light on my pulse. The simple fact was that we couldn't keep our hands off each other, no more than Fergus and Massali could, despite the fact that we knew very well such behaviour would lead only to greater frustration.
"Aye, well, in my own defence, I meant well," he said ruefully, smiling down into my eyes.
"Well, you know what they say about good intentions."
"What do they say?"
His thumb was stroking gently up and down my wrist, sending small fluttering sensations through the pit of my stomach. I thought it must be true what Mr. Willoughby said about sensations on one part of the body affecting another. "They pave the road to hell." I gave his hand a squeeze and tried to take mine away, but he wouldn't let go.
"Mm-hmm."
His eyes were on Fergus, who was teasing Massali with an albatross's feather, holding her by one arm and tickling her beneath the chin as she struggled ineffectually to get away.
"Very true," he said. "I meant to make sure the lass had a chance to think what she was about before the matter was too late for mending. The end result of my interference being that I lie awake half the night trying not to think about you, and listening to Fergus lust across the cabin, and come up in the morning to find the crew all grinning in their beards whenever they see me."
He aimed a vicious glare at Maitland, who was passing by. The beardless cabin boy looked startled and edged carefully away, glancing nervously back over his shoulder.
"How do you hear someone lust?" I asked, fascinated.
He glanced down at me, looking mildly flustered.
"Oh, well, it's only..."
He paused for a moment, then rubbed the bridge of his nose, which was beginning to redden in the sharp breeze.
"Have you any idea what men in a prison do, Sassenach, having no women for a very long time?"
"I could guess," I said, thinking that perhaps I didn't really want to hear firsthand. He hadn't spoken to me before about his time in Ardsmuir.
"I imagine you could," he said dryly. "And you'd be right, too. There's the three choices. Use each other, go a bit mad, or deal with the matter by yourself, aye?"
He turned to look out to sea and bent his head slightly to look down at me, a slight smile visible on his lips.
"Do you think me mad, Sassenach?"
"Not most of the time," I replied honestly, turning round beside him. He laughed and shook his head ruefully.
"No, I didna seem able to manage it. I now and then wished I could go mad," he said thoughtfully. "It seemed a great deal easier than having always to think what to do next. But it doesna seem to come natural to me. Nor does buggery," he added, with a wry twist of his mouth.
"No, I shouldn't think so." Men who might in the ordinary way recoil in horror from the thought of using another man could still bring themselves to the act out of desperate need. Not Jamie. Knowing what I did of his experiences at the hands of Jack Randall, I suspected that he very likely would have gone mad before seeking such resort himself. He shrugged slightly and stood silent, looking out to sea. Then he glanced down at his hands spread before him, clutching the rail.
"I fought them, the soldiers who took me. I'd promised Jenny I wouldn't. She thought they'd hurt me. But when the time came, I couldn't seem to help it."
He shrugged again and slowly opened and closed his right hand. It was his crippled hand, the third finger marked by a thick scar that ran the length of the first two joints. The fourth finger's second joint fused into stiffness so that the finger stuck out awkwardly, even when he made a fist.
"I broke this again, then, against a dragoon's jaw," he said ruefully, waggling the finger slightly. "That was the third time. The second was at Culloden. I didn't mind it much. But they put me in chains, and I minded that a great deal."
"I'd think you would."
It was hard, not difficult, but surprisingly painful, to think of that lithe, powerful body subdued by metal, bound and humbled.
"There's no privacy in prison," he said. "I minded that more than the fetters, I think. Day and night, always in sight of someone with no guard for your thoughts but to feign sleep. As for the other..."
He snorted briefly and shoved the loose hair back behind his ear.
"Well, you wait for the light to go, for the only modesty there is darkness."
The cells weren't large, and the men lay close together for warmth in the night, with no modesty save darkness and no privacy save silence. It was impossible to remain unaware of the accommodation each man made to his own needs.
"I was in irons for more than a year, Sassenach," he said.
He lifted his arms, spread them 18 inches apart, and stopped abruptly, as though reaching some invisible limit.
"I could move that far, any more, he said, staring at his immobile hands. And I couldn't move my hands at all without the chain making a sound.
Torn between shame and need, he would wait in the dark, breathing in the stale and brutish scent of the surrounding men, listening to the murmurous breath of his companions, until the stealthy sounds nearby told him that the telltale clinking of his irons would be ignored.
"If there's one thing I ken very well, Sassenach," he said quietly, with a brief glance at Fergus, "it's the sound of a man making love to a woman who's not there."
He shrugged and jerked his hands suddenly, spreading them wide on the rail, bursting his invisible chains. He looked down at me then with a half-smile, and I saw the dark memories at the back of his eyes under the mocking humour. I saw, too, the terrible need there, the desire strong enough to have endured loneliness and degradation, squalor and separation. We stood quite still, looking at each other, oblivious of the deck traffic passing by. He knew better than any man how to hide his thoughts, but he wasn't hiding them from me. The hunger in him went bone deep, and my own bones seemed to dissolve in recognition of it. His hand was an inch from mine, resting on the wooden rail, long-fingered and powerful. If I touched him, I thought suddenly, he would turn and take me here, on the deck boards. As though hearing my thought, he took my hand suddenly, pressing it tight against the hard muscle of his thigh. "How many times have we leaned together since you came back to me?" he whispered. "Once, twice in the brothel, 3 times in the heather, and then at Lallybroch, again in Paris." His fingers tapped lightly against my wrist, one after the other, in time with my pulse. "Each time I left your bed as hungry as ever I came to it. It takes no more to ready me now than the scent of your hair brushing past my face, or the feel of your thigh against mine when we sit to eat. And to see you stand on the deck with the wind pressing your gown tight to your body." The corner of his mouth twitched slightly as he looked at me. I could see the pulse beat strong in the hollow of his throat, his skin flushed with wind and desire.
"There are moments, Sassenach, when for 1 copper penny I'd have you on the spot, back against the mast and your skirts about your waist, and devil take the bloody crew."
My fingers convulsed against his palm, and he tightened his grasp, nodding pleasantly in response to the greeting of the gunner coming past on his way toward the quarter gallery. The bell for the captain's dinner sounded beneath my feet, a sweet metallic vibration that travelled up through the soles of my feet and melted the marrow of my bones. Fergus and Massali left their play and went below, and the crew began preparations for the changing of the watch, but we stayed, standing by the rail, fixed in each other's eyes, burning.
"The captain's compliments, Mr. Fraser, and will you be joining him for dinner?"
It was Maitland, the cabin boy, keeping a cautious distance as he relayed this message. Jamie took a deep breath and pulled his eyes away from mine.
"Aye, Mr. Maitland, we'll be there directly."
He took another breath, settled his coat on his shoulders, and offered me his arm.
"Shall we go below, Sassenach?"
"Just a minute." I drew my hand out of my pocket, having found what I was looking for. I took his hand and pressed the object into his palm. He stared down at the image of King George III in his hand, then up at me.
"On account," I said.
"Let's go and eat."
This ends Disc 23. Voyager, Disc 24.
The next day found us on deck again. Though the air was still chilly, the cold was far preferable to the stuffiness of the cabins. We took our usual path, down one side of the ship and up the other, But then Jamie stopped, pausing to lean against the rail as he told me some anecdote about the printing business. A few feet away, Mr. Willoughby sat cross-legged in the protection of the mainmast, a small cake of wet black ink by the toe of his slipper, and a large sheet of white paper on the deck before him. The tip of his brush touched the paper lightly as a butterfly, leaving surprising strong shapes behind. As I watched, fascinated, he began again at the top of the page. He worked rapidly, with a sureness of stroke that was like watching a dancer or a fencer, sure of his ground. One of the deckhands passed dangerously close to the edge of the paper, almost, but not quite, placing a large dirty foot on the snowy white. A few moments later, another man did the same thing, though there was plenty of room to pass by. Then the first man came back, this time careless enough to kick over the small cake of black ink as he passed. The seaman exclaimed in annoyance. He scuffed at the black splotch on the otherwise immaculate deck.
"Filthy heathen! Look here what he's done!"
The second man, returning from his brief errand, paused in interest.
"On that clean deck, Captain Raines won't be pleased, will he?"
He nodded at Mr. Willoughby, mock jovial.
"Best hurry and lick it up, little fella, before the captain comes. Aye, that'll do. Lick it up. Quick now!"
The first man moved a step nearer the seated figure, his shadow falling on the page like a blot. Mr. Willoughby's lips tightened just a shade, but he didn't look up. He completed the second column, righted the ink cake, and dipped his brush without taking his eyes from the page, and began a third column, hand moving steadily.
"I said," began the first seaman loudly,
but stopped in surprise as a large white handkerchief fluttered down on the deck in front of him, covering the ink blot.
"Your pardon, gentlemen," said Jamie. "I seem to have dropped something."
With a cordial nod to the seaman, he bent down and swept up the handkerchief, leaving nothing but a faint smear on the decking. The seamen glanced at each other, uncertain, then at Jamie. One man caught sight of the blue eyes over the blandly smiling mouth and blanched visibly. He turned hastily away, tugging at his mate's arm.
"Not at all, sir," he mumbled. "Come on, Joe, we're wanted aft."
Jamie didn't look either at the departing seaman or at Mr. Willoughby, but came toward me, tucking his handkerchief back in his sleeve.
"A very pleasant day, is it not, Sassenach?" he said.
He threw back his head, inhaling deeply.
"Refreshing air, aye?"
"More so for some than for others, I expect," I said, amused. The air at this particular spot on deck smelled rather strongly of the alum-tanned hides in the hold below.
"That was kind of you," I said,
as he leaned back against the rail next to me.
"Do you think I should offer Mr. Willoughby the use of my cabin to write?"
Jamie snorted briefly.
"No, I've told him he can use my cabin or the table and the mess between meals, but he'd rather be here. Stubborn wee fool that he is."
"Well, I suppose the light's better," I said dubiously, eyeing the small hunched figure crouched doggedly against the mast. As I watched, a gust of wind lifted the edge of the paper. Mr. Willoughby pinned it at once, holding it still with one hand while continuing his short, sure brush strokes with the other.
"It doesn't look comfortable, though." "It's not."
Jamie ran his fingers through his hair in mild exasperation.
"He does it on purpose, to provoke the crew."
"Well, if that's what he's after, he's doing a good job," I observed.
"What on earth for, though?"
Jamie leaned back against the rail beside me and snorted once more.
"Aye, well, that's complicated. Ever met a Chinaman before, have you?"
"A few, but I suspect they're a bit different in my time," I said dryly. "They tend not to wear pigtails and silk pyjamas, for one thing, nor do they have obsessions about ladies' feet. Or if they did, they didn't tell me about it," I added, "to be fair." Jamie laughed, and moved a few inches closer so that his hand on the rail brushed mine.
"Well, it's to do with the feet," he said. "Or that's the start of it, anyway. See, Josie, who's one of the whores at Madame Jeanne's, told Gordon about it, and of course he's told everyone now."
"What on earth is it about the feet?" I demanded, curiosity becoming overwhelming. What does he do to them? Jamie coughed, and a faint flush rose in his cheeks.
Well, it's a bit.
You couldn't possibly tell me anything that would shock me, I assured him. I have seen quite a lot of things in my life, you know. And a good many of them with you, come to that.
I suppose you have at that, he said, grinning.
Oh, well, it's not so much what he does. But, well, in China, the high-born ladies have their feet bound.
Well, I've heard of that, I said, wondering what all the fuss was about. It's supposed to make their feet small and graceful.
Jamie snorted again.
Graceful, I? Do you know how it's done?
And proceeded to tell me.
They take a tiny lassie, nae more than a year old, aye, and turn under the toes of her feet until they touch her heel, then tie bandages about the foot to hold it so.
Ouch, I said involuntarily.
Yes, indeed, he said dryly. Her nanny will take the bandages off now and then to clean the foot, but puts them back directly. After some time, her wee toes rot and fall off. And by the time she's grown, the poor lassie's little more at the end of her legs than a crumple of bones and skin, smaller than the size of my fist.
His closed fist knocked softly against the wood of the rail in illustration.
But she's considered very beautiful then, he ended. Graceful, as you say.
That's perfectly disgusting, I said. But what has that got to do with... I glanced at Mr. Willoughby, but he gave no sign of hearing us. The wind was blowing from him towards us, carrying our words out to sea.
See, this was a lassie's foot, Sassenach, he said, stretching his right hand out flat before him. Curl the toes under to touch the heel, and what have ye in the middle?
He curled his fingers loosely into a fist in illustration.
What? I said, bewildered.
Jamie extended the middle finger of his left hand and thrust it abruptly through the centre of his fist in an unmistakably graphic gesture.
A hole, he said succinctly.
You're kidding. That's why they do it. His forehead furrowed slightly, then relaxed.
Ooh, am I jesting? By no means, Sassenach, he says.
He nodded delicately at Mr. Willoughby.
That it's a most remarkable sensation. To a man.
Why, that perverted little beast! Jamie laughed at my indignation.
Aye, well, that's about what the crew thinks, too. Of course, he canna get quite the same effect wi' a European woman, but I gather he tries now and then.
I began to understand the general feeling of hostility toward the little Chinese. Even a short acquaintance with the crew of the Artemis had taught me that seamen on the whole tended to be gallant creatures, with a strong romantic streak where women were concerned, no doubt because they did without female company for a good part of the year.
"Hmm,"
I said, with a glance of suspicion at Mr. Willoughby. "Well, that explains them all right. But what about him?"
"That's what's a wee bit complicated."
Jamie's mouth curled upward in a wry smile.
"See, to Mr. Yi Chang Chong, late of the Heavenly Kingdom of China, we're the barbarians."
"Is that so?" I glanced up at Brodie Cooper coming down the ratlines above, the filthy, calloused soles of his feet, all that was visible from below. I rather thought both sides had a point. "Even you?"
"Oh, aye. I'm a filthy, bad-smelling Guao Fu. That means a foreign devil, you ken. We are a stink of a weasel. I think that's what Huang Shu Lang means. And the feast like a gargoyle," he finished cheerfully.
"He told you all that?" It seemed an odd recompense for saving someone's life. Jamie glanced down at me, cocking one eyebrow.
"Have you noticed, maybe, that very small men will say anything to you when they've drink taken?" he asked. "I think brandy makes them forget their size. They think they're great hairy brutes and swagger something fierce."
He nodded at Mr. Willoughby, industriously painting. "He's a bit more circumspect when he's sober, but it doesn't change what he thinks.
It fair galls him, aye.
especially knowing that if it wasn't for me, someone would likely knock him on the head or put him through the window into the sea some quiet night.
He spoke with simple matter-of-factness, but I hadn't missed the sideways looks directed at us by the